Well, I mean, it's kind of late.
Do you have to get home? I asked.
Almost hopeful. My mom don't care what time I get home. What about your dad? My folks are divorced. She said it with a pinched dignity, as if she admired the act but disagreed with the principles behind it. What about Dusty? Dusty? Why would he care? She reached down into the trash on the floor of the truck. I had forgotten to clean it out. She brought back Mom and Dad's wedding picture. This your folks? She asked. It came with the frame, I said. She giggled. You look like your dad, she said, and gave me a hesitant smile. I'm sorry about all that. All that. The letters floated in front of my eyes, soft and puffy, like the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland had blown them from his hookah. I blinked them away. Yeah, all that really sucked, I said. I know it's been real hard on Amber. It's really changed her a lot. Yeah, she used to be human. She laughed again, letting it trail off into another giggle.
Amber says you're real funny.
She was still holding the picture, one of her purple polished thumbnails covered Mom's face. I thought about grabbing the back of her neck and smashing her face into the glass. You don't want to go home yet? I said, looking away from her and the picture. Not really. What do you want to do? I don't know. It's such a hot night for this time of year. We could go over to the reservoir. You got a blanket in the truck? I've got a coat. The glass shards embedded in her forehead would twinkle in the moonlight when I laid her down on it. Okay, she said. We weren't the only couple out on a Friday night who had come up with the reservoir idea. The sight of all the cars and trucks, some of them solitary and rocking, others covered with kids sitting on the hoods and trunks, smoking and drinking, and laughing about shit they weren't going to find at all funny in a couple more years, irritated me. I suggested to Ashley we try the township park. Except for a couple making out on the slide and another one on the swings, the place was empty. I parked my truck facing away from the playground and toward the softball field. You want to go there? Ashley asked, staring out the windshield at the pitcher's mound. I wanted to wash her face. She wore too much makeup. I knew she did it to look older, but it had the opposite effect. She reminded me of all those child beauty queens that were on TV and the tabloid covers after that one was murdered. Little Miss Lovely. Little Miss Physical Stimuli. Little Miss Pedophilia. That was Skip's joke. And if she was from Philly, she'd be Little Miss Philadelphia Pedophilia. And we tried to say it 10 times fast sitting in the mining office, all grown up now, with beers stolen from our dads instead of bologna sandwiches made by our moms. What are we going to do when we get there? I asked her, glancing at the mound. What? What are we going to do when we get there? I asked again, slower and louder, like I was talking to a dim-witted Girl Scout. Whatever you want, she said. Whatever I want. Maybe she had misunderstood. Maybe she thought I was talking about a choice between tag or hide-and-go-seek. Maybe this was all a big joke.
Why had Amber set me up on a date in the first place?
Since when did she do me favors? Was Ashley going to turn me down? Was that it? Or was she going to make it with me and tell Amber all about it? Were they going to sit around with the interchangeables and crucify me? Do you think I'm ugly or something? She said in a low, personal tone, like she was discussing the possibility with herself. No. I'm on the pill, she added with holiday eagerness. Most guys get real excited over that. A sharp pain stabbed me above the eyes. You know what that means, she said, lowering her voice to a whisper. No rubbers. My hands started shaking, but I smiled anyway. I was torn in two by a violent desire to be like most guys, and a helpless need to be me. Aren't you kind of young to be on the pill? I asked her.
My mom put me on it. She says she doesn't want me ending up like her.
She put one of her hands on my leg and moved toward me. I let her kiss me. It wasn't much of one on my part. She pulled away, mildly stunned, and fixed me with the straining, empty eyes of someone who had been recently blinded. I pushed her away, maybe too hard. She crashed into the passenger side door and gave a small, wounded cry when her naked shoulder hit the window handle. She stayed perfectly still in the corner, staring at me, frozen not by fright, but by glaring disbelief. I started the truck. At the first cough of the engine, she tried to kiss me again. I saw her lips coming at me with the deadly intent of a charging bull. The back of my hand met the side of her face, and I heard her head make a hollow clunk against the window glass. She broke into sobs. "I lied," I said. "I think you're ugly." It was for her own good. I didn't know how I ended up at Callie Mercer's house. I couldn't remember where I had left my truck, if I had gone home first, if I had left it parked on the side of the road somewhere. Mrs. Shank had told Misty I sat in front of their house for an hour. I didn't believe it then, but now I wasn't so sure. I had taken a roundabout way, following the railroad tracks, crossing her creek, approaching the house from an angle where the dogs couldn't see me. A light burned in the jungle room. The worst part about tonight was not having anyone to talk to. No Skip, no Dad. I was old enough now I could have talked to Dad about sex. We'd come close once. The first time I went out with Brandy, he had been home, and as I was leaving, he told me to remember a few seconds of ecstasy wasn't worth a lifetime of driving a cement truck. He had said it laughing, and my mom had called out, "Thanks a lot," from the kitchen. All I heard was a few seconds of ecstasy. Callie was sitting sideways on a white wicker couch, wearing a big t-shirt and nothing else, with a mile of bare leg draped over one of the armrests. She was reading a book and had a beer sitting on the floor next to her. I changed my mind. The worst part about tonight had been finding out I didn't want the one thing I was counting on to make me feel good. There would be no relief from living. Her husband came into the room. He walked over to her and his lips moved. She looked up from her book, and I thought to myself, if he touches her, I will die. Chapter 8. All those times me and Skip tried to kill Donnie were just for fun. At least they were for me. I never wanted to kill Donnie. The truth be told, I kind of liked him, although I would have never told Skip that. Donnie radiated contentment, a sleepy, lying in the sun kind of mental bliss I had never known. Even when Skip yelled at him or pushed him around, he seemed okay with it. One time we barricaded him in a closet for a whole day trying to suffocate him. I broke into a cold sweat when we went back and knocked on the door and didn't get an answer. But Skip didn't get scared at all.
We moved the chairs away, opened the door, and a couple seconds later Donnie slid out on his belly, blinking, saying he was a nightcrawler.
I was sure my fondness for him was nothing more than little brother envy since I only had Amber, a chattering shadow who turned cartwheels for no reason and left every room smelling like watermelon lip smacker. I thought the best thing about having a little brother would have been the luxury of occasionally forgetting he existed. I was thinking about Donnie because I had noticed Skip didn't mention him in his letter. I had it sitting on the counter next to Callie Mercer's recipe for bean and macaroni soup. I couldn't imagine writing anyone a letter without mentioning the girls, even if I was living away from them. It would have been there in my thoughts whether I wanted them to be or not. Skip's letter had seen better days. Some of the words were beginning to rub off, and the creases were gray and shiny from being folded and unfolded too much. I would have gone to visit him that very minute if I had the money. I thought about my schedule, searching for an extra chunk of time where I could stick in a part-time job.
The ice cream places, the drive-in, the miniature golf courses would all be hiring soon.
Some already were. Weekdays, I worked 9 to 5 and 7 to midnight. Weekends, I sometimes worked the same, but every once in a while, I had a day off like today. I could be handing ice cream cones to Ashley and most guys and getting paid for it instead of making soup and getting abuse for it. The bacon in the pot sizzled and popped. I was supposed to be sauteing it with a finely chopped onion and 2 minced garlic cloves and olive oil, which we didn't have. I wasn't sure what saute meant, but I was pretty sure it didn't mean burn the crap out of it. I gave the brown mess a stir with Mom's wooden spoon. Most of it stuck to the bottom of the pan. I turned down the heat and added the can of whole tomatoes. The recipe said to chop them up, so I started ripping at them with the spoon, thinking about Ashley again. I sensed Jody standing behind me. "You're not supposed to burn it," she said.
"Are you sure about that?"
I replied without turning around to look at her.
"It says right here in the recipe, be sure to burn it." She darted up next to me and left a note on the counter.
"Dear Harley, I hope you feel better. Your sister, Jody." I hadn't been in a very good mood when I finally rolled out of bed that afternoon. I didn't look too good either. I knew Jody was still in the room with me.
"What?"
I shouted.
"You're supposed to put little leaves in with the tomatoes."
"Sorry, we're fresh out of sage. Esme's mom grows it in her garden."
"Good for her."
I kept stirring. Misty joined Jody. They lurked in the doorway and talked in whispers.
"Did you get my note?" Jody asked me.
"Yes," I said.
"I really meant it."
"Thanks."
"Can we go to the Lickin' Putt?"
"Can you get a job?"
"Told you,"
Misty grunted as Jody slumped back to her. "Add salt and freshly ground pepper to taste. Simmer for 10 to 12 minutes.
"Freshly ground pepper," I muttered to myself.
I grabbed Mom's pepper shaker, shaped like an Amish guy, and dumped a ton in. I set him back down next to his wife in a black bonnet, carrying a basket of apples. Men were always pepper, women always salt. Black, white, evil, virtuous.
"You prick," Amber seethed.
I heard her bare feet pad across the kitchen tile. She sounded naked. I glanced at the front of the microwave to catch her reflection in it. She had on a crocheted bikini top and a pair of cutoffs decorated with lace. I didn't know how I was going to survive another summer of her lounging around in a bathing suit. The one she wore last year was chiseled into my brain with the cosmic permanence of the Ten Commandments on stone.
"I figured something might go wrong, like you wouldn't be able to get it up or you wouldn't know where to put it," she said. "But I never expected you to hit her. You never hit me."
"What are you talking about?" I whirled around and spattered tomato juice all over her bare belly. She flinched at the sight of it and at the sight of the spoon, her blue eyes showing a moment of pure, depthless fear before she came splashing back to the surface to find her rage floating reliably above her like a life preserver. She took hold of the bottom of my shirt with a yank and wiped off her belly with it.
"I just got off the phone with Tracy. She said Ashley said you hit her."
"Who the hell is Tracy?"
"You met her last night at the mall."
"Right. Was she the slutty-looking one, or the slutty-looking one?" She eyed me with weary disgust.
"Where do you get off with that attitude? Everyone's too stupid or slutty or lazy for you. Who do you think you are?"
"God."
"You do," she laughed dryly. "You probably think you're better than God. If you ever met him, you'd probably tell him to get a job."
She walked over to the kitchen table still covered with last night's dinner dishes and straddled a chair.
"You're so fucking stupid, Harley. Ashley really likes you."
"She doesn't even know me."
"She's known you her whole life."
"I'm not talking about riding the same bus." I heard the chair legs drag across the tile. She came up beside me again, and I automatically stepped away. Her body had the power to repel mine without touching it. We were like the wrong ends of magnets. "Add chicken broth and cannellini beans." I read off Callie's recipe card. "Be sure to rinse and drain beans first."
"How do you think people get to know each other?" Amber asked me,
her voice sounding almost pleading.
"You think God's just going to drop a woman in your lap? You're going to wake up one day and there's going to be some smart, beautiful virgin living down the road who works 5 jobs and has a thing for loser headcases?
What are cannellini beans?"
"That's probably what you're always mumbling about in your sleep," she murmured.
"What?" I said. Her eyes darted in my direction. Then she walked back to the table and started clearing it with a determination she usually reserved for channel surfing. She clattered the 2 plates into the sink. Neither one of us had been home for dinner the night before.
I spotted a piece of crumpled notebook paper on the top plate. It had to be Misty's. It was licked clean.
I opened up the note and showed it to Amber. Esme says the babies will be defective. Amber crinkled her nose. What is that supposed to mean? I shrugged. That little Esme gets on my nerves, Amber said, crushing the paper back up and throwing it in the garbage can under the sink. She thinks she knows everything. She's so promiscuous. I felt a sudden surge of big brother protectiveness when I heard her mistake, like I wanted to kill a spider or carry a heavy box for her. Precocious, I corrected her. Right, she answered, curling her lip skeptically. You're just telling me that so I'll use it sometime and sound stupid. I wondered if she even remembered that she used to trust me. My mind flashed back to a time we were fighting over my crayons. I wouldn't let her have any of them, and she went and tattled to Mom. Mom said I had to give her at least one, so I gave her white. I waited for her to figure out what I had done while I silently busted a gut and applauded my evil genius. But she had walked off contentedly and sat down at her white piece of paper to draw me a picture of sugar, salt, and snow. Outside, Elvis started barking up a storm. I heard a truck coming up the drive, and from the other room, Jody squealed, "It's Uncle Mike!" Amber ran out of the kitchen to go put some clothes on. Jody and Elvis were already bouncing around the truck before he put it in park. He got out, resting a case of beer against one hip, and surveyed the place. He hadn't been out since February, and everything had been covered with snow then. The only thing he could find to criticize was the lack of firewood stacked next to the house. Fortunately, he never went inside. He and Dad had been close. He reached down and gave Elvis a scratch between the ears and handed Jody a Butterfinger. She hugged his leg and skipped back to the house. I knew Misty wouldn't put in an appearance. She didn't like Uncle Mike because one time he told Dad he should spend more time with me and less with her. Those for me? I asked about the beer. They were Rolling Rocks, not the piss water he usually brought.
Well, they're not for Elvis. Here, take them. You look like you're going to kiss me, for Christ's sakes.
I took the case from him. He spit a bullet of tobacco in the yard and helped himself to one of the beers. I set the case down and opened one, too.
You get a new couch?
He asked me, looking at the carcass. Elvis had ripped open one of the cushions, and little pieces of blackened upholstery and yellow foam were spread everywhere. He had pulled off the bedspread, too, and dragged it to his doghouse.
Thinking about it, I said. Most people wait until they get the new one before they burn the old one.
I guess I was overeager. He gave me a sideways glance. His eyes were hard to read, hidden in the shadow beneath the brim of a brown and gold PennDOT cap.
You being smart with me?
No.
That was your grandma's couch.
That had nothing to do with my decision to burn it.
You are being smart with me.
Dad's mom had always been a sensitive topic with the kids. There were three of them, Mike, Diane, and Dad. None of them could stand to be around her, and behind her back they called her a drunk and groaned about visiting her. But in person, they waited on her like she was the Queen of England. When she died, they acted like they were going to crawl in the grave with her. Then the next day, they were whistling and joking around while they boxed all her earthly belongings and drove them off to the nearest dump. I never felt like I knew her well enough to form an opinion on her. She was either very nice or very mean, and neither side of her personality seemed to be her real self. Grandpa, on the other hand, was always mean. He did nothing but sit in his recliner and rant about the environmentalists in Congress who had shut down all the mines. He had already been retired before his mine closed, but apparently he resented that his sons and grandsons didn't have a job waiting to kill them, too. His cough terrified me, a harsh, wheezing hack that always made me think he was going to spit up one of the black lungs his disease was named for. He kept an empty coffee can with him all the time, half filled with his tarry phlegm. They were a pair, Dad's folks, but they were the only grandparents I ever had since Mom's folks were killed when she was a kid. She hadn't been close to the great aunt and uncle who took her in. She never said anything bad about them, but sometimes when she talked about marrying Dad, she said he had saved her from them. I chugged my beer, crushed the can, and dropped it on the grass. It gave me a nice buzz. I hadn't eaten anything since my popcorn with Ashley. I'm sorry, I apologized to Uncle Mike. I'm not feeling so hot today.
Now that you mention it, you look like hell.
He dropped his gaze to my shirt.
Were you gutting something?
I was making dinner.
Why don't the girls do that?
They do. We take turns.
You bring home the paycheck. You shouldn't have to go anywhere near a kitchen.
They shouldn't either. They're just kids.
Amber's not a kid. Where is she, anyway?
Out running around with a boy, I suppose.
She's inside, I told him, scrubbing floors and doing laundry. She doesn't have much time for a social life. She's so busy helping out around the house.
Amber?
Mm-hmm. I nodded over my beer can. He finished his beer and reached for another. I had noticed a rattle in my truck earlier I would have liked to ask him about, but if he stayed to fix it, he would drink all my beer.
When are you gonna mow?
Today, I said emphatically.
You're going to need to get to that soffit and fascia this year. And the trim on those windows. That wood's going to rot right off if you don't put a fresh coat of paint on. Did you ever clean out your gutters?
Today, I said. I'm going to do it today. Amber came out of the house in a prim, pale yellow t-shirt dress, sprinkled with little blue flowers, and her hair pulled back in a ponytail with a ribbon. She still managed to look like a slut. She said hi to Uncle Mike and gave him a hug. He told her she got better looking every time he saw her, and she acted like she didn't know what he was talking about, like she had never seen a mirror. I knocked off my second beer and belched. Amber looked over at me.
How's Mike Jr. doing?
She asked Uncle Mike, slyly, and watched for my reaction. Amber and I didn't agree on much, but we both hated our cousin Mike. I didn't know why she hated him so much, but my feelings were fairly straightforward. My whole life I had been forced together with him at every family gathering, and he had used every opportunity to outthrow me, outrun me, out-eat me. He never showed up anywhere without a football trophy or a Polaroid of his latest buck stretched out dead across the hood of his truck, or his latest girlfriend stretched out drunk across a friend's couch.
He's doing great, Uncle Mike gushed. They're starting training already. He's raring to get back out there. He was their third leading rusher last year. He's hoping to be number one this year.
I'm sure he will be, Amber said, smiling at me. Mike's the best. He sure is, I said, reaching for another beer. The ground came rushing at me too fast, and I thought I was falling, but I kept my balance. I straightened back up and heard Uncle Mike tell Amber we should try and make it up for one of the home games this year. Notice how he just said, try and make it up, I muttered to Amber. It's not like he'd want us inside the stadium with them. She started giggling.
What's so funny?
Uncle Mike asked, smiling too.
I was just telling Amber how much I'd enjoy that. Mike could show you around, he said to Amber. You could meet some of the players.
Maybe I could meet a cheerleader, I added.
Amber grinned at me. She reached for my beer and took a sip off it.
Mike's dating a cheerleader,
Uncle Mike volunteered.
Really?
I said. Amber burst out laughing, and Uncle Mike's smile faded.
Well, I guess I'll leave you two to your private joke, he said. We're sorry, I said. No, it's all right, he replied angrily. I'm used to it. A lot of people are jealous of Mike's success. The only way they can handle it is to make fun of him.
Is that why they do it? I whispered to Amber. She collapsed against my arm, laughing.
Okay, all right.
He shook his head and backed away.
I guess I'll be going. I was only trying to help out a little.
As little as possible, I whispered to Amber again, and we both started howling. Uncle Mike got in his truck and slammed the door. The sound cut through my drunken fog and made me realize what I had done.
Hey, we're sorry, Uncle Mike,
I called out, running over to his truck. He started backing out.
Really, we're sorry, we're just kidding around.
He raised his hand in a wave and shook his head at me disappointedly. Uncle Mike had been the only person at Dad's funeral who spent any time with me one-on-one. He took me for a walk after the burial, with his arm around my shoulders. The two of us, strangers to ourselves and each other in our dark suits and stiff shoes, with our heads bare, and the dirt missing from beneath our fingernails. He led me silently down row after row of polished headstones. Every once in a while, I'd noticed a small, flat, gray stone engraved with the word baby. I couldn't figure out what they were supposed to mean. I thought parents always picked out a baby's name before it was born, so how could a baby die nameless? The only answer I could come up with was after the baby died, the parents took the name back because they didn't want to waste it. Even my dad being lowered into the ground didn't seem as big a betrayal as that. I imagined all these dead babies without names going up to heaven and being put in a big holding pen like livestock before slaughter, while the angels tried to figure out who they were supposed to have been. Suddenly I couldn't handle all the injustices in life and how a lot of them didn't even seem to end with death.
I started shouting in short, explosive bursts about what a joke Dad's funeral had been.
How he had lived here his whole life and knew a ton of people, but hardly anybody showed up. Uncle Mike waited for me to get it out of my system, for me to kick a tombstone and hurt my foot because I was wearing shoes instead of my steel-toed work boots, for me to finally start crying, and for me to finally stop crying. I eventually took a seat with my back up against a big speckled gray slab. Uncle Mike's voice came to me from above and behind.
"From the moment people heard, they made a choice," he instructed me. "You and your sisters are either the children of a murdered man or the children of a murderer. If you're one, you deserve sympathy. If you're the other, you deserve hatred. But you can't be both, because people can't feel both."
I let his words sink in while I thought about how Mom had asked Uncle Mike to buy Dad a new suit to be buried in, even though we couldn't afford it, and how Uncle Mike had done it, but then the funeral was closed casket.
I thought about how Mom had sent a condolence card from her prison cell to Aunt Diane.
I thought about how even now, after seeing my dad in the ground and seeing my mom in handcuffs, I still couldn't shake the feeling that he was the criminal and she was the victim.
"Awkwardness kept them away today, and it's going to keep them away tomorrow," Uncle Mike finished before he walked off. "You better get used to it."
I stayed there until Aunt Jan finally came looking for me, talking about the glaze hardening on a baked ham and the perils of spoiled potato salad. I wasn't sure which revelation had stunned me more, the fact that something as trivial as awkwardness could destroy something as powerful as decency, or the fact that Uncle Mike had been the guy who figured it out. I waited until his truck disappeared, then I started pitching rocks at the empty dust cloud. "Who needs him?" Amber said. "He was my beer connection," I moaned, and laid down in the middle of the dirt. "Maybe Betty could start getting it for you," Amber suggested. That one killed me. I lay on the ground and laughed until every muscle in my gut hurt. I had tears in my eyes when I looked up and saw Misty standing over me, wearing oven mitts and holding a smoking, black-bottomed pot. She dropped it. "What the fuck?" I cried, rolling away just in time to keep it from hitting me square in the forehead. "I'm not washing that," she said, and went back inside. The girls had frozen pizza for dinner. Around my sixth beer, I started feeling antisocial and decided I didn't want to eat with them. I took two more beers, a bag of chips, and Elvis, and went off down the road. My plan was to hike to the railroad tracks and follow them to California like Skip and I used to fantasize about, but I had to stop about a quarter mile down Potshot to take a leak. While I did, I stared into the black woods, and they stared back. Even drunk in the dark, I could find my way around them. They were my woods. I didn't own them, but they belonged to me because I had taken the time to get to know them. Ownership was about power. Belonging was submission. I wasn't even sure who owned this land along the road. For all I knew, Callie Mercer did. I wasn't going to be able to pay the real estate taxes this year. They were due the first week of June, and I had nothing saved. If the bank took my house, I wondered if Callie would let me live on her hills. I could be one of those wild-eyed mountain hermits with mice nesting in my beard. I could pull down some of the boards from the mining office and build a lean-to in her clearing. I could hunt and fish and season my kill with sage stolen from her garden. One moonlit summer night, she might appear with her book and her beer and her blanket and her mood swings. The effort of pissing away a six-pack tired me out. I whistled for Elvis and staggered back up the hill. He came tearing over to me as I sat down next to my truck and gave me a couple rowdy licks on the face. I grabbed him by the ruff of his neck and pushed him to the ground. He let me lie on his softly thudding chest for about 10 seconds before he jerked up with his big paws flailing, but it had been enough comfort to put me to sleep. I woke up a couple hours later, cold and damp, my mind numb and blank. I didn't dream anymore. I had told Betty this, and she said I just wasn't remembering any of them, but she was wrong. I was sure something had been breathing in my ear, but it turned out to be my own hair blowing against it. A breeze had kicked up. The air was heavy with an incoming storm. Across the yard, the night grass shivered in ripples of silver and black. It took me 2 tries to find my feet. I steadied myself against my truck with one hand and inched my way around it.
Elvis was at the side of the house, growling and shaking a limp gray body so hard it kept smacking him in his own head.
I had to kick him to get him to drop it. I knelt down over the torn, bloody body. It was a groundhog, a baby one. "Get!" I hissed at him. He jumped away like he'd been kicked again and sat down a couple paces away from me. I went to the shed, casting glances over my shoulder and pausing every couple steps to make threatening lunges back in his direction. A shovel was right inside the door, but he was at the body again by the time I found it. I chained him up. I buried what was left of the groundhog near the tree line. After I was done, I stabbed a stick in his grave and slipped an upside-down beer can over it. I named him Rocky. Elvis strained at the end of his chain and gave me a final hopeful bark as I walked past him to the porch. I ignored him. He looked first at me, then at the grave, then stretched and laid down in the dirt, with the calm surrender of a creature who knows he will eventually be set free. I only made it as far as the living room. The sight of a floor covered in pillows was too tempting. It called to me like a lake on a scorching hot day. I held my arms out to my sides and fell into them, face first, and drifted down to the bottom. I woke up to the sound of breathing again. This time I was sure it was Mom. She'd fallen asleep with me in my race car bed, her arms wrapped around me, and her hands clamped together like a padlock.
Then I was sure it was Jody back in the red jello days. She used to have nightmares, and Amber and I took turns lying with her while she tossed and turned and mumbled and wrung Sparkle Threehorn like a wet washcloth.
When she finally calmed down and fell into a deep sleep, I always did too, even though I knew she was going to pee the bed. Then I relaxed into the certainty that it was Amber. She had crawled into my bed again, sleeping behind me with her body pressed against my back and her arms and legs wrapped around me. Most nights I hated it, but some nights I gave in and let the warmth and weight and smell and softness of her overwhelm me. I belonged to someone. I took her hand and pulled her tighter against me. Her breath tickled my neck. "Harley," she whispered. We were alone beneath my covers. We were alone beneath our card table fort, listening to gunshots.
"Harley, are you okay?"
"Huh?"
"Harley, wake up."
I was still on my stomach. I hadn't moved a muscle from when I fell into the pillows. My eyes flew open and I lay perfectly still as reality sank in. I wasn't a kid anymore. Amber squeezed my hand and leaned over to see if I was awake. Her hair brushed my face like a spray of perfume.
"It's not such a big deal what happened with Ashley," she whispered in my ear. "You could have talked to me about it instead of getting shit-faced."
I rolled away from her and sat up. The motion made my head spin.
"Were you afraid? Is that it?" she asked.
"Huh?" I said, groggily.
"I was afraid my first time," she told me. "That's why I picked out Ashley for you. I wanted you to be with someone who loves you, so she could help you."
My eyes began to make her out in the dark. She knelt next to me in a stretch lace chemise. Victoria's Secret had done wonders for my female undergarment vocabulary.
"Help me how?" I asked in a croak.
"I don't know," she said quietly.
"But that's what I always feel like I'm looking for when I fuck someone. Help? I couldn't make out the expression on her face, but I could make out the lace pattern against her skin and the absence of anything beneath it. I started backing away from her in a crab crawl and bumped into a wall. "What's wrong?" she asked and started toward me.
"Don't," I suddenly shouted.
"Don't what?"
"Stay there."
I got to my feet and held out my hands, praying for the power of a crossing guard. "Are you freaking out again?" she asked. She started to stand, and I dropped my head and squeezed my eyes shut. "Jody told me what happened when you saw Mom."
"Great. Just great." I laughed out loud.
"A dinosaur and a Happy Meal. $10. 10 wasted bucks. 20 wasted bucks on Ashley."
"Why don't you ever tell me anything?" she kept at me. "You could have told me that. I wouldn't have made fun of you."
She was coming, getting closer and closer. I could feel her even though I couldn't see her.
"You were afraid of her, weren't you? You were afraid to touch her," she said in a trembling voice. "You can touch me."
She took one of my hands in both of hers and started to raise it. And she stopped suddenly, blocked by her own intentions. I opened my eyes. She stared back at me without seeing, her jaw lifted in defiance, but her face tranquil. I ripped my hand out of hers. I whirled around and stumbled over my feet, trying to get away.
"What's wrong?" she said frantically. "What are you doing?"
I didn't waste time trying to stand. I scrambled across the floor on my hands and knees.
"You prick," I heard her say. "You bastard! You fucker! You son of a bitch!"
She chanted like a teacher calling roll.
"You prick," she said again, coming up behind me.
Anger had returned to her voice. Once she was completely hidden behind it, I could usually be fooled into facing her again.
"You're supposed to take care of me, too."
An unseen force yanked me to my feet, but it pushed me too fast. It was dark. I ran into a wall, but I kept my balance. Amber's breath seared my neck.
"What about me?"
she screamed. The front door was a dream door, an arm's length away, but impossible to reach. I gathered all my strength, but it was more than I needed. The momentum threw me outside. I tripped down the porch steps and hit the ground face first. White light burst in front of my eyes, and the salty, sweet taste of blood filled my mouth. Amber came out on the porch, crying harsh, bitter sobs. I raised up on all fours. Beneath me was a round gray rock jutting from the grass like a wart. Tiny black splashes of blood hit it with a steady raindrop rhythm. A sticky warmth crawled down my chin.
"I don't love any of them," she screamed at me. "I hate all of them. I want you to know that. I want you to think about it all the time."
I staggered to my feet and took off at a run. Behind me in the dark front window, I saw sparkle. Mom's shears danced, and it was gone. I didn't slow my pace until I came to Blacklick Road. I walked down the very middle, knowing if someone came around a blind curve at this hour, they would have no choice but to kill me. My lungs burned. My face throbbed. I checked my mouth with two fingers to make sure I still had all my teeth, and found a dent on my bottom lip where the skin had been parted. I wiped my fingers on my jeans and left a long, dark smear. There was no light to guide me or lead me. I looked up at the black sky patched with cast-iron storm clouds. The moon was distant and milky gray like an old man's sightless eye. I kept walking. I didn't know where I was going, but I knew what I was leaving, and that was enough motivation. When a house materialized out of the gloom, my first thought was to pass it by, but instinct pulled me toward it. Not to use as a form of refuge, but to use as a target for my building rage. I stopped and filled my hands with roadside gravel. Dogs started barking, ruining my plan for a sneak attack on the house, but I was already halfway down the driveway, so I started whipping rocks at them instead. An outdoor light went on. The dogs barked louder. I threw harder. A door opened and Callie Mercer peered out.
"What?"
she started to say. She stepped outside barefoot and bare-legged in a short white nightshirt that said, "World's Greatest Mom."
"Harley, is that you? My God, what happened to your face?" I looked down at the rocks still waiting in my hands, and I wondered for a moment, was it me? She started across the driveway, not feeling the sharp stones beneath her feet. I searched the horizon for an escape route, over the dark sloping yard, past the onyx glint of the pond, through the wall of hills, to a fierce black line with no end in sight. I dropped the rocks and started running again, slipping on the dew-slick grass and swearing at the pain that flared from my lip each time my foot connected with the ground. When I got to the creek, I stopped. It was only 5 feet across, but it stretched out before me as wide as any river. My knees buckled, and I collapsed on the muddy bank, beaten. I was lying on my side, staring at the rustling water when I heard her heavy breathing and the crack of a branch. She got down in front of me on her knees and put her arms around me. I thought about resisting out of pride, but I couldn't remember if I had any. "I'm not going back there," I said, and started to cry. I circled her waist with my hands and buried my face in her lap. "You don't have to," she said quietly, and held my head against her. "I never understood how you could stand to stay there in the first place." She didn't make me feel better. I felt worse. I sobbed harder, hoarse, ugly sounds like my grandpa's cough. "It's okay," she said. "It's not okay. It's not ever going to be okay." "Not so hard, Harley. Don't hold me so hard," I moaned. "Shh," she murmured. I clutched her tighter, rubbing my face all over her like a blind pup. My cheek brushed across her nipples, and she took in a sharp breath. It felt too hard to be part of the rest of her. "You're right," she said, her voice catching in her throat. "It's not okay. I can't make it okay. Do you understand that?" I slipped my hands down over her hips, along her legs, up under her nightshirt. She was naked. The feel of her made me lose my mind. I couldn't tell what parts I was touching, and I didn't care. They were all the same. They were her. I pushed her down in the mud. I kissed her belly with my torn lips. I kissed her thighs. I kissed her everywhere. That's all I wanted to do, kiss her. I kissed her breasts. Her nipples weren't hard at all. I felt like I could crush them with my lips. I tried, and she cried out, and I jerked back, panting. She was smeared with my blood. "It's all right," she said. She reached beneath my shirt. Her fingers stroked my stomach and chest, then slid into the waistband of my jeans. I made some kind of noise, a cross between a war whoop and a death rattle. She didn't seem to understand that in about 30 seconds I was either going to come or throw up. "I can't," I groaned. "What?" "Wait," I finished. "I can't wait." She pulled her hand out and rushed to undo the button on my jeans and unzip my fly. I just watched. I was way past handling small manipulative skills. I wasn't afraid at first. I wasn't afraid when I pushed inside her and felt my mind, body, and soul twist themselves into one raw nerve. I wasn't afraid when she gasped and called out to God, and I realized there were two people having sex here, not just me. I wasn't even afraid when I realized I wasn't going to last long enough to bring her anything but frustration. The fear came when I realized my dad had been wrong. It was worth a lifetime of driving a cement truck. It was worth a lifetime. The end neared, and my hands started trembling so hard I couldn't hold on to her anymore. All my efforts to bring her to me were like grappling for a handhold in crumbling earth. I gave up and let go, and let her hold on to me. I came with my fists clenched above her. Chapter 9. When I opened my eyes again, I felt like I had been asleep for 100 years. I was so sure of it, I was afraid to look around. I thought I might find an alien world without trees and grass, where the houses were built in the sky, and shiny silver people flew around with jetpacks on their backs. I didn't want to look at my body either.
I didn't want to see a gray, sunken chest and a withered old pecker. I didn't want to see Bud's brown-spotted hands or Betty's white thighs with inky veins like windshield cracks. I remembered my grandpa on his deathbed hooked up to a respirator, cursing environmentalists. His skin had lost all its color by then, paling until I could see every pearl-blue vein beneath its surface. All I could think of was worms, and how he looked like he was already being eaten by them from the inside out. The last time we visited him in the hospital before he died, Dad told him he was looking better. I remembered glancing over at the two of them, wondering if they were seeing something I couldn't see. Grandpa had nodded, and his bony hand, sprouting with tubes, had jerked up like he meant to touch Dad, but before he could, it fell, crumbled onto the sheet like a bird shot from the sky. Dad explained later it had been a muscle spasm. They didn't talk after that. Dad sat in the chair next to him, unable or unwilling to look anywhere but out the window. I started getting mad at him. This was his big chance to pour out his soul without being afraid or embarrassed because Grandpa was dying and couldn't hold anything over him anymore. I knew they had a lot to talk about because they never did. They communicated solely through pace and posture. I knew Grandpa still hit Dad, and that had to bother him. If a kid outgrew his dad's piggyback rides, it seemed only fair he should outgrow his punches, too. But I had witnessed it. I saw Grandpa cuff him once out in his backyard. He caught him in the side of the head, and Dad took a few faltering steps backward before finding his balance and shaking off the blow like an athlete shaking out a cramp in his leg. I had been shocked more by Grandpa's nerve than what he did. Dad was bigger than him in height and weight, and in my mind they were equals since they were both adults. But Grandpa had a skinny fierceness about him and chipped eyes as black and blunt as the coal he missed mining, while Dad had traded attitude for endurance. Except for when he was beating his kids, his personality was insignificant. Back in the hospital room, remembering that day, I began wondering if the way Grandpa treated Dad explained a lot about the way he treated me. Maybe if Grandpa had never hit him, he would have never hit me. Maybe it was that simple. But it might not have been Grandpa's fault either. Maybe his dad had hit him. Then I started thinking about Mom, and how different her life would have been if that trucker hadn't dozed off on his way from Sheboygan to Chicago with a trailer full of bratwurst and wiped out her family. She would have never moved here. She would have never been looking for someone to save her from an old aunt and uncle who didn't want her around. She would have never screwed my dad and got pregnant. Was that how life worked? Was that nameless, faceless trucker from my mom's past responsible for me getting smacked every night? Or was it the fault of a great-grandfather I never knew staring at me from a black-and-white family photo with eyes like my own? Or did I need to go back further, hundreds of years, tracing dozens of generations, back to the first guy who hit his kid, back to the first random act of God that made a child an orphan? It got too complicated for an 8-year-old. All I knew for sure was Dad blew his chance to work things out with Grandpa. It wasn't fair he got the chance and I didn't. I wouldn't have wasted it. If I had known Mom was going to kill Dad that night as I went off to Skip's house to drink contraband beers and bullshit about horny college chicks, I would have stopped first and cleared some things up. I would have asked him why he didn't like me. I would have apologized for being a disappointment to him. And I would have told him I loved him, because I did, in some joyless, unsatisfying way that hurt instead of healed, but I knew it was still love. It wasn't enough love to keep his memory alive, though. Or maybe it was the wrong kind. It hadn't even been 2 years yet, but I already had a hard time picturing Dad's face. I found it easier to conjure up the cast of the A-Team. Still, sometimes I could see him and sometimes I could hear his voice. I could replay certain events like the day in the hospital with Grandpa. I could recite facts about him the way I could about certain historical figures. He supported his family. He gave excellent piggyback rides. He remembered his anniversary, kept his yard mowed, and hunted and drank with his buddies. He wasn't too smart, but he didn't need to be. He wasn't enlightened, but he didn't want to be. But I couldn't remember his presence in my life. A stick started digging into my back. I reached under my shoulder blade to pull it out. My arm moved slowly, heavy with sleep or old age. I started thinking about the shiny silver people again, and then an episode of The Flintstones popped into my head. The one where Fred takes a nap at the company picnic, and when he wakes up, he has a white beard down to his knees, and Pebbles is off marrying Arnold the paperboy. The same panic he felt suddenly rushed over me, along with the certainty that I had slept through my sister's lives. 20 years later, and they were all still living at the top of the hill, with the roof sliding off the house and the porch sagging badly to one side. The grass was 3 feet high, all 4 doghouse doors choked with goldenrod and Queen Anne's lace, the rusted frame of my old truck home to a family of possum. The couch was missing, and I knew Misty had dragged it back inside, and I also knew she sat on it at night and thought about Dad. She was the only one who had a job. I didn't know what it was, but it didn't matter. She hated it the same way I hated my jobs because she knew she was worth more, but she also hated herself, so there wasn't much point in trying to do better. A lousy life for a lousy person. The punishment fit the crime. Amber was pushing 40 in stretch pants and too much makeup, bitter and scared, realizing too late that most of her life would be lived after 30. But she never was good at math. At least she didn't have a bunch of illegitimate kids running around. She had a scraped-out uterus instead, and her dreams were plagued by dead babies who always had names. But Jody was the worst. She had returned to the red jello days. I could see her, but I wasn't with her.
She sat at the kitchen table, mute and useless, the little girl gold gone from her hair, the bottoms of her feet in bloody tatters from that piece of Dad's satellite dish I never got around to ripping out of the ground.
I tried calling out to her, and I found myself in bedrock with Fred, running from one stone chapel to the next, chasing after Pebble's doomed giggle. I came awake with a jolt. The storm clouds had scrubbed the night clean, leaving behind a fresh black sky, pinpricked with stars. Night bugs chirped, and the creek made a sound like a snake gliding through grass. The air was chilly, but my skin itched and tingled. If flesh could simmer, this was how it would feel. My body wasn't old after all. My arms and legs weren't feeble. I felt stronger than I ever had in my life, yet nothing about me seemed solid anymore.
I thought of pictures I had seen as a kid of swirling galaxies, and how I used to wonder what held them together. Refusing to believe in gravity, wanting to believe the planets all stuck around because they knew it was where they belonged.
Something big had happened. Maybe God had come looking for me again, appearing this time in the form of Fred Flintstone, since the moon was too distant tonight to supply the silver light. It looked man-made, like a small ivory button. I turned my head to one side and saw the Virgin Mary standing naked in the creek. More beautiful than I ever imagined. She bent down and splashed water over herself, then stood again and tilted her face toward the trees, wearing her shy, waiting for God smile. Her lines made me ache. I watched her hands rub her arms and throat and move in circles over her stomach and breasts. And enlightenment was mine. God made them that way on purpose. Getting kicked out of the Garden of Eden and being forced to earn our bread by the sweat of our brows wasn't man's punishment. We were damned the minute God decided to make women beautiful. And women were damned for the same reason. She finished washing and walked to the water's edge, where she stopped to pick something out of her hair. She glanced my way and I squeezed my eyes shut. It was a reflex reaction, like she might possess the same powers as that mythology witch with the snakes on her head, who could turn men to stone. God had turned Lot's wife into a pillar of salt. Who knew what he'd do to some guy spying on his girlfriend? I waited to see if she'd come to me again, if I would feel her breath on my face and her fingers on my chest, if she would take my hand and lead me to a better place. Instead, I heard a very human shit and the sound of her sucking in her breath in pain. I looked over and saw her hopping around on one foot, all her grace and innocence gone. And I remembered everything. Who she was, who I was, what we had done,
what I had run away from. What she probably was running away from in order to fuck around with me. I understood perfectly that there was no way she could love me. Enlightenment sucked. She placed her foot gently back on the ground and reached down for her nightshirt. She had her back to me, and the sight of her bending over brought me to a sitting position. She probably could have brought me to a floating position if she had stayed bent over long enough. But she stood up and slipped into her shirt, checked the bottom of her foot once more, and went walking off into the grass without looking back. I wanted to yell after her, but I couldn't figure out what to call her. Mrs. Mercer? Esme's mom? She'd never given me permission to call her Callie. My heart started beating too fast. I lay down and closed my eyes again and tried to sort out what had happened. I'd always thought if a guy did a good job at sex, the woman was left limp and breathless, purring maybe, gazing at him with dumb animal love the way Elvis looked at me while I scratched his chest. She had taken a bath in a freezing cold creek and left. A terrible sinking feeling came over me as I realized I might have already blown it. I couldn't buy her nice things, or take her places, or provide her with witty conversation. All I could do was fuck her well. That was the only way I could keep her. It was cold now. I would have given anything for Dad's coat. I didn't know where my shirt was, but I could feel my jeans down around my ankles. I thought about wearing them that way for the rest of my life. "You show them, Harley," Church would have said. I started to shiver, but my crotch stayed warm and sticky. There in the dark with my eyes closed, a woman's pussy juice didn't feel all that different from blood. Dawn was breaking when I finally started on my way up Potshot Road. The woods were noisy with bird calls. A raccoon scurried across the road in front of me, hurrying back to his dark den with a vampire's urgent need to avoid the coming light. His thick, shaggy body and delicate black hands and feet looked like they belonged on different animals, like God had been in a hurry to finish him off and just slapped on the first set of paws he could find. I took my time walking the hill. A gray mist had settled over everything, absorbing the weak morning light and giving the air substance. I stuck my bare arm out into it and brought it back covered in shimmer. I breathed it in deeply,
letting its feather weight fill my lungs and roll over my tongue. It tasted sweet and empty, like purity should. I approached the top and slowed down even more in case deer were grazing in the clearing.
The biggest flock of wild turkeys I had ever seen were spread out over the grass eating, their dark, darting bodies rippling with copper glints. There must have been 30 of them. Good-sized ones, too. Instinct made me pause by the tree line, waiting to see if a gun was going to pop. They didn't notice me at all. I walked past them and sat down in our front yard where I had a good view of them, and the green hills dropping away behind them like folds in a blanket. The sun had risen into a patch of clouds and turned them golden pink. Their color made me think of peaches, and how peaches would be in season soon, and we'd be selling them at the ShopRite for a dime apiece during our annual 10-cent produce sale, and Jody would be walking around barefoot, with her face buried in one, juice dripping down her chin and wrists, and me yelling at her to go eat over the sink. School would be out in a month, and Amber would be saddled with the girls all day long again. This summer wouldn't be as bad as last summer, since Misty and Jody were more adjusted now, and older too. The first school year was the worst time we had been through so far. Jody only had a half day of kindergarten and no one could watch her in the afternoon. Amber and Misty were in school. Aunt Diane taught school and had three little kids of her own. Uncle Mike's wife, Jan, never volunteered and none of us liked her anyway. We couldn't afford a sitter or daycare. For a while, I dragged Jody around with me looking for a job. She was always good. That was back when she wasn't talking. She would sit quietly staring at her fingers while I filled out job applications and talked politely to guys in dockers with sticks up their asses because they were the almighty assistant managers of shoe stores and discount warehouses. One guy asked me if I'd brought along my little sister to make him feel sorry for me so he'd give me the job. After that, I made Jody wait in the truck. My hours at ShopRite were pretty flexible. I was able to work a lot of nights and weekends and still watch Jody, but the money wasn't enough. I had to get another job, the one at Barclays Appliances, but I was able to sneak Jody along with me some days. She loved playing in the warehouse behind the store, where she made caves out of the empty refrigerator boxes and hid with her dinosaurs. Whenever Ray and I had to go on a delivery, she rode with us. Ray was okay with it, not because he was a swell guy, but because he loved the idea of pulling one over on the boss. We must have violated 100 different insurance laws having her in the truck with us. He constantly reminded me, clutching the steering wheel and grinning at me like we were driving away from a bank robbery. Even with me taking Jody to work now and then, Amber still ended up cutting a lot of school to stay with her the days I couldn't. Eventually, a truant lady came out and had a talk with us. She said it was a shame that Jody wasn't Amber's child because then we could have put her in the free daycare school provided for teen mothers who could demonstrate need. I asked her to define need. She said financial need. Girls who couldn't afford real daycare and would have to drop out of school to take care of their children instead. I pointed out we couldn't afford real daycare, and Amber was probably going to end up dropping out of school to take care of Jody. She said we couldn't participate in the program because Jody wasn't Amber's child. I said she was my child. I had signed the papers making me the legal guardian of all my sisters. My mom had signed them, too. She said I wasn't a student anymore. I had graduated. The school couldn't do anything for me. And I said, so you mean if Amber did something stupid like get pregnant and have a baby, you guys would cut her a break and help her out, but we can't get any help? The woman had stared back at me with flattened lips and a stony look in her eyes, and I could tell she wanted to say, you don't deserve any. Those people were out there. I had encountered them before.
Ones who read the newspaper stories or saw the news reports and decided to not only condemn my mom, but hate her guts as well.
Some of them even seemed to think we should be punished too. I kind of flipped out a little after that. I started ranting about how teenaged girls who have babies should be expelled from school, how anyone that stupid wasn't ever going to be a productive member of society anyway, how the schools shouldn't be wasting their time with daycare, they should be tying down every girl in a halter top and stabbing that birth control implant under her skin. How I didn't care if it was a violation of her civil rights, the ACLU could take a flying leap. I meant all of it, too. That's what I hated most about what was happening to me. I couldn't feel sympathy anymore. The truant lady waited patiently until I finished. My behavior didn't faze her at all. She dealt with much worse around here. At least we weren't filthy or starving or lice-infested or drunk. We weren't covered in bruises anymore, either. And I wanted the girls to stay in school, and they did too. She said she'd get back to us. Maybe Jody could be an exception. I stood at the front window and watched her walk across our yard in her wrinkled plaid skirt and gray blazer, and thought about all the women I had dealt with recently wearing Walmart workday separates from the Kathy Lee collection, and all the men in suits from JCPenney's. The first couple weeks after Mom's arrest, we were shuffled from one official-looking government building to the next. We talked to detectives, lawyers, shrinks, bill collectors, correctional facility personnel, undertakers, reporters, social workers, bankers. We buried Dad and said goodbye to Mom through plexiglass. The last place I went was Laurel Falls National Bank to talk to a guy who worked for Callie Mercer's dad about getting a break on our mortgage payments for a month or two. He said the bank would like to be able to help, like the bank could think and feel. But if they gave an extension to one customer, they would have to give extensions to everyone. I argued that maybe they could only give extensions to kids who lost both their parents unexpectedly and simultaneously and had no money and no job. That would probably limit the amount of people who would qualify. He smiled and made a very small laugh and said, yes, it probably would. And I asked him if maybe I could talk to the bank instead of him. Maybe the bank knew our house socially. The guy looked at me like I was certifiable. That was right after the shooting, and the whole gory mess was still fresh in everyone's mind. I got up and walked over to the Pennsylvania Scenic Wonders calendar hanging on his office wall. The month of August was a bright red barn sitting in the bottom of a bright green valley, surrounded by bright blue sky.
I had lived in this southwestern corner of the Allegheny Mountains my entire life, and I had never seen a barn or a day that color.
I motioned at the barn with my thumb and asked, "Any relation to the bank?"
I swore I saw him reach under his desk and press a silent alarm. He had me figured for a definite type.
When I got home, all three girls were sitting on the porch waiting for the verdict. Looking at them, I had one of my flashes of enlightenment, and it was this. Nobody knows we are here.
I had the same thought watching the truant lady leave.